Catherine Grinberg is here. She's got that executive vice president role with the Fargo-Moorhead West Fargo Chamber of Commerce. This doctor that's sitting next to you, Catherine, I'm going to let you introduce this Kempsey's guy. Where'd you get him? I heard he hit the ball out of the park in there.
He did. Yeah, he was our first keynote speaker, so I'm happy to introduce Dr. Walter Kempsey, the managing partner of Kempsey's Group. He's widely viewed as one of the most foremost experts on ports, rail, infrastructure in the U.S., so really looking forward to our conversation today. But really came to us from a connection through the Sinners. And when we got connected with him, we had a great call to talk about what do you want to talk about at the Ag Summit. And boy, let me tell you, he had a plethora of really interesting things, charts to show, kind of a lot of different topics. And so we said, well, it sounds like we should just title the keynote, What Matters Most in Agriculture. And that's how we came to his keynote address. So I'll turn it over to Dr. Walter Kempsey's. But yeah, fantastic keynote to open the session today.
Good to have you here in the upper Midwest. How did it go in that room over there? A lot of friends.
Oh, absolutely. This is, by the way, not my first trip to Fargo.
Okay.
I've been here before for another conference down in Castleton, where the Bob's Farm is.
Yep.
And, you know, the reception here is just absolutely fantastic. I think Fargo is the unrecognized agricultural Silicon Valley. And all the stuff that I heard yesterday that Bob has been telling me, you know, over the last few years, it's just fantastic to come here and see the people involved, to see the public sector elected representatives, the agencies, the private sector folks, just single-mind focused on creating a really badly needed new outlook.
Yeah. Well, part of what I was anxious to get a chance to talk to you about is moving that product. You know, obviously we're very good here in the upper Midwest at raising that product, but being able to move it, the infrastructure it takes to move it. You say that the Silicon Valley here in the Fargo-Moorhead area, you know, one of the things that we lack, well, we've got two interstates going by.
Right.
But do we have enough rail? Do we have enough access to the ports and the seas? And give me your take on how we sit geographically for the future.
Yeah, well, you know, the infrastructure that we first built in this country was for movement of domestic goods. It wasn't designed to move imported stuff. Mm-hmm. But over the decades, the other countries learned that our ports were well connected for domestic freight movement, and they learned to take advantage of that, and that's why we have a trade deficit. You know, we're a prosperous country, and
we have money and we want to buy things.
Exactly.
Yep.
And, but what people don't realize is that we may have a dollar trade deficit because when you bring in, is let's say we just do two containers. One's got Nike sneakers and the other's got soy. Okay. The value per ton of a Nike sneaker is a huge multiple of what it is for soy. However, when you just look at the weight of the cargo, how many tons come in and go out, we run a trade surplus. It's things like agriculture that gives us that surplus, you know, plus energy and other
sure.
kinds of products. But it comes from agriculture.
I never thought of it that way. You know, just the sheer size, you know, yeah. That's a perfect way to put it, because I always thought when you think of it, you think of, man, they've got this much coming in, when in fact the value of some of what we're buying, whether it's chips, whether it's Nike, you know, all of that is just, it's valued is way higher.
Exactly. And, you know, our government does not want our technology, whatever goes into our technology, to be made abroad anymore. That's why we're subsidizing.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
It is a very good thing, because, you know, every major country has done this in the past. They offer to build free telecommunication systems, etc., and there's listening devices in it. And, you know, it's getting harder and harder to detect these things. So
safe to say you're not on TikTok?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, but you look at Intel, Apple, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation, the two Korean companies, they've all been given billions of dollars to build the fabs here in the U.S. And we've also cut out exports to China. So let them go figure out if they can do this. Probably not. But nonetheless, we are turning this thing around. And it really matters a lot, because one of the things I talked about earlier today, and I want to go back to if it's okay with you.
Yeah.
We don't have working age population growth. And we're still doing.
We've been talking about that a lot on the show today.
Okay. That's yeah. That's my centerpiece. I grew up and I spent my career in a world where I had working force population growth, productivity growth.
Yeah.
I could forecast GDP out 10 years and be awfully accurate. But the next generation of economists, you know, as I step out and they step in, they have a problem. If you don't have working age population growth, then economic growth is from productivity. And how do you forecast productivity growth? And so I'm beginning to understand it little by little. You take, how important is ag to the U.S. economy? 15% GDP. I'm making the number up, but it's probably around there. And then I look at how the productivity growth changes in agriculture. Yep. And so that's why coming to Fargo and getting to talk to the guys with the, was it the Grand Farm, you know, project.
Yep.
That's what's fascinating. You know, as we lose workers from the rural parts of the country to the urban parts, how are we going to make the food? Because if we can't make food, our national security is not there.
But it isn't just that, as you know. I mean, you look at one of the biggest mistakes I think China has made economically is the fact that they're now on a ratio of one. They limited each family to how many kids they could have. You mentioned the sinners. I think Bob is one of, what, 62 kids in that family?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I mean, there's a ton of them, right?
There are a lot of sinners at my table.
Exactly. You know, and so, you know, nobody's having kids like that anymore, meaning we're not developing. I mean, you and I are probably pretty close to the same age.
Mm-hmm.
I remember fighting for that summer job.
Yeah.
You just wanted that. If you got that summer job and the neighbor down there, I got the job. You know, I've got a summer job. Now, there's so many summer jobs open, you can't, you know, if you're a 17-year-old, you could wave a stick and have 10 jobs.
Well, and see, there's another part to that, too. There are a lot of towns that had all of the rich people move in, and they pushed up the cost of real estate and the businesses. And, for example, there's a... In Wilmington, it was a very nice old restaurant that was, especially in the summer, as people went to the beach, Wilmington, North Carolina, sorry.
Yeah.
They were open for decades, and they just shuttered because they can't get workers. It's not that the workers didn't want to work there. It is that they have to live so far away that they can't afford to drive to work. If they move in close, they can't afford the rent. And so this is happening around the world, London, Paris, New York, but... You know, increasingly down to smaller and smaller size cities.
Okay.
And so this is another part of the problem that's in place. It's harder to get the workers because they got to go to places where they have affordable housing. And we're not emphasizing that enough in the country.
I couldn't agree more. Go ahead.
The other thing that Walter got asked this morning that was super interesting related to this conversation is immigration and how that plays into the workforce problem.
We should play poker because that's right exactly where I was going with this.
Yep.
What was your answer on that?
So here's the thing. In both Europe and in the U.S., when an immigrant family moves in, they have as many kids as they can. I mean, they make rabbits look unproductive. Right, because they want to put in roots, spread the roots, go in deep. Great. Those children are not immigrants. They may still speak the mother tongue. They may look foreign or not typical American, but they're Americans, and they're going to have as many kids as the average American does. So you let the immigrants in, there's this big influx of people. There's this big birth rate jump, and then right back to where you were. So You have to use immigration as a continuous solution. The problem is, around the world, population growth rates are dropping drastically. In many countries, they've gone negative, and this is because we're urbanizing. See, a child in rural Brazil is valuable. You can put them to work, and when you get old, they can take care of you. So you have a lot of kids, you know, 10, 12 if you can, and you're good. In a city, a child is a negative asset. You're going to have get buy a bigger house when you have a child. They're going to have dental work, maybe plastic surgery if they're a little homely when they turn 16. They go to private school. They're going to go to college. You have to buy them a car, and then when they graduate, they move back into your house and eat you out of house and home. All right, so children are expensive in urban areas, and they don't generate a lot for you. I mean, you don't even have enough grandchildren. I only have one, mm-hmm. You know, so I'm complaining about it. I want three.
Yeah.
But anyways.
I'll give you three. I got six.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me borrow some.
Yeah.
But anyways, the point is that when you move into if you urbanize the population growth slows. The United Nations thinks we're going to get to 9.7 billion people by 2050. I probably won't get to 2050, so I could laugh and point out that we didn't.
Yeah.
I don't think we're going to get to 9 billion.
Well, let's go back, though, because for you, I think you're right about so much of this, but mm-hmm. the truth is, if I brought 20 workers in, no matter what color, no matter what language, no matter what, and I got my buddies around and say, these 20 guys need a job, give them a chance. You know how long it's going to take them to get hired?
A day?
Not even. Yeah. Get in the pickup. Let's go. Oh, let's see what you can do.
Bob and I went out to have dinner yesterday, and at the first restaurant that we wanted to eat at, they had a sign that says, we're closed this Monday because we don't have enough workers.
Exactly.
I actually put it in the slide deck. I couldn't help myself.
Yeah. I mean, it's the way it is. And you know, you mentioned it, you know, the setting down roots, and I would also argue a lot of it's got to do with work ethic.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, it's just, I knew I was going to reach this age where I was going to say, in my day, you know, but the truth is, you know, now, if you look at many people, they consider a 45-hour work week a long work week.
Oh, yeah.
I don't get it. I mean, to me.
Actually, starting now, the UK is experimenting with a 4-day work week.
Yeah.
So if you have a lot of automation, you can pull that off. Right. Not necessarily ChatGPT or any of that kind of stuff. But basically, if you think about it, and I've worked in an office until 2016, and I started working from home. I was at Moffitt and Nickel, then I jumped to JLL, but I worked from home. I just went on strike. I travel a lot for the work I do. So but I my productivity shot through the roof because we didn't have 4 conversations a day at the coffee maker, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
We get paid to talk at radio, so we encourage. Dr. Walter Kempsey's is our guest. He's the managing partner with Kempsey's. We're going to hang on to you for a second because I want to talk about competing against other countries. Richland IFC, Brandenburg, a friend of mine that I get to talk to every now and then and just get to get Rick's take on where we're at with some of the markets. And, you know, he started talking about the infrastructure one time to me of what other countries are building to do future trade, and it scared the hell out of me. So I want to talk to you about this. We're coming to you live from the Butler Building. We're talking at the Ag Summit here, the Midwest Ag Summit, with Dr. Walter Kempsey's. He is someone that understands moving product, and that's what we're going to get to now. Dr. Kempsey's, in terms of ports, in terms of infrastructure, I'm just going to get out of the way. You explain what's going on.
Okay, a couple of key things. During the pandemic, during the worst of it, the government set up a couple of task forces, and we are working on making sure that whatever assets we have to move goods are used more efficiently than they were during COVID. So one of these big things is Project Flow, freight logistics optimization works. This project has got everybody throwing their data in, everybody meaning truck companies, trains, ocean carriers, ports, owners of chassis, everybody who owns a transportation, a piece of the supply chain, adds their data together to the U.S. Department of Transportation. And we're going to use that to figure out when things are going to get bad, when they're going to flare up in different parts of the country. Hopefully this will also help farmers in, for example, North Dakota, who need to know where can they get their hands on empty containers so they can fill it up with their product and ship it out.
Okay.
So that's a big thing the government is doing, and it's finally, we're trying to close the gap between our physical infrastructure and our information technology infrastructure because one's way ahead of the other.
Okay.
So that's one big piece of it. The other piece that's going on here is we are investing in more port capacity, primarily in the Southeast. You're seeing a new terminal in Baltimore, expansion of capacity in Norfolk. Charleston just opened a brand new container terminal. Savannah is converting a railroad terminal to containers. And Mobile is expanding. New Orleans is building a new terminal. Houston is building a new terminal. They're working on their roadways, their railways, to make sure it's all very fluid. This matters particularly to the exporters, because the more efficient we make the routes for getting things out of the country, the cheaper the cost of sending something to a foreign market, and we can own a larger part of the world. So we do compete with many other countries for things. But one of the things that's creating some interesting changes in the world is the U.S.-China relationship. You know, China has 100 ports around the world. They're trying to acquire even more. It's part of their Belt and Road Initiative, where they can, you know, dominate the world economy. And because of the security risk that this presents, American companies have been encouraged, and European companies, to not produce stuff for Europe and North America in China. So a lot of the production is shifting to Vietnam, to India. You heard Tesla the other day is going to open a new factory in India. Last year, September, Apple says they were going to do the same thing. So what happens is those containers, that product, when it comes to the U.S., it comes via the Mediterranean, the Suez Canal, over to the U.S. East Coast. So as we shift away from China, and China's population is aging, they're no longer the largest population on the planet. Their working age population has been declining since 2016. You've got this rising India, and that's a great target market for us. And so our infrastructure planning and thinking that I've been involved in for the last 17 years, we knew these things were coming. And so I'm pleased to say that the U.S. is better prepared than most people would think.
There. All right. Well, you taught me about two things in there for sure. I thought you were going to say something else. So you're on your game. Thanks for being in North Dakota. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me here.
You bet.